just want to know, you spent a year there. Now, how did it come that you went down as an expedition member? Were you involved in Antarctic research before then, or was that your introduction?
That was my introduction to Antarctic research. I had been a full-time student up to doing a master's degree at UCT, and I was getting tired of being a full-time student. I wanted to earn a bit of money, but I wanted to do something interesting at the same time, sort of keep my hand in science but have an adventure. And I sort of heard about the Antarctic through my master's supervisor at Cape Town, who sort of knew the then head of physics at Rhodes, Frederick Glettel. And he suggested that I contact him and find out about this Antarctic thing. And I did. And he said, okay, well, you know, go and spend a year in Antarctica and then get some data and come back and do a PhD. So that's kind of what I did. I spent a year at Rhodes 4, going down to Sena. So that was 1974. Mm-hmm. So I started my PhD project then, so it's a preparation then. Spent 1975 at Sanai, then came back and spent another 3 years, six, seven, eight, yeah, 3 years, finishing my PhD. And so I graduated from Rhodes. Well, they had the graduation mm-hmm. early the following year, so it was early 1979 that I graduated. PhD. So yes, it was an opportunity to do science in an interesting environment. Mm-hmm. That's really what it amounted to. You know, I had an idea that I wanted to continue doing science, but I didn't want to just stay, mm-hmm. you know, sitting sort of full time mm-hmm. in university. So it came at just the right time, and you know, I saw it as an opportunity. And the you know, the science was interesting. It wasn't directly related to what I've been doing in my master's degree. Sort of related, I mean, in the sense that I was doing plasma physics, and this was sort of applied plasma physics in a sense to the upper atmosphere. Other than that, it was not related, but it seemed very interesting. And I had the opportunity as well, in a sense, because the roads just purchased some new equipment at that time, and had in mind to set up a sort of a new experiment, which I basically set up, because the old way of sounding the ionosphere, which is what they were doing, basically sending vertical radio signals up to the ionosphere and getting reflections mm-hmm. back. The old equipment was kind of pulsed, as they say, they send a short burst and then wait for the thing to get reflected and come back again. And the new equipment they purchased at that time was what they call a chirp ionosonde. So basically it sort of sweeps up in frequency rather than sort of sending pulses mm-hmm. and so on. So it was a different idea. But they bought two of these things, and it actually presented the opportunity of having one in Grahamstown and one at Sanai communicating between the two. And that's essentially what I did. I looked at radio communication between Sanai and Grahamstown. And so, yeah, it was a new project. It was an interesting, it was a good opportunity. And I got a PhD out of it. Then, after I got my PhD, I then thought, well, I need to get a job.
Yes.
as you'll find, I'm sure. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll sort of look around for lecturing positions at universities. And what was available at that time, I think I applied for and got offers from the University of Transkei, which I decided, no, I'll pass up on that one, and UNISA. And so I went off to UNISA to lecture. there's no Antarctic research or anything there. I thought, this isn't really where I want to be, but it was. I thought, well, you know, I'll use it as a kind of stepping stone. And actually, sooner than I kind of expected, a position came up in Durban. And so that was 1980. And so I applied for that, and I've been here ever since.
Durbanized since.
and involved, you know, in the Antarctic program in one you know, one way or another, pretty well, you know, the whole time since then.
So did you get a second opportunity to go down?
I went down for the summer, for the takeover period. That would have been 86, 87, okay. Yeah. So that was the, what, you know, what we now call Sanai 3, you know, because we spent 1975 in what, you know, Sanai 2,
yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting during that time, during the 86, 87 visit, to, because the RL base was still accessible, just.
Yes.
So we could actually go down into and sort of crawl around and see these collapsed structures and things.
Did Antarctica change much between 75 and...
Antarctica hadn't changed much. I mean, there's a bit more snow on top of the old place, so it was really, you know, crushed. But, yeah, you know, it was interesting. I think the thing about going down just for the summer, you know, is that it kind of doesn't really get dark, you know. So you don't really, you know, if you're interested in stars or anything like that, you know, then it's there's not much to see. But, you know, obviously from a wildlife point of view and so on, you know, it's interesting to go in the summer and there's lots to do usually in a short time.
So what's the Agalas much different from the RSA? Because I presume you first went on the RSA and then on the Agalas.
Yeah. Well, it was certainly bigger and better, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the memories of the old RSA were, it wasn't a very pleasant boat to travel on, as I'm sure you've heard from many people. you know, it sort of surprised me initially, you know, that this small little boat, you know, is kind of what took everything down to Antarctica, you know, to supply this whole operation. You know, then seeing the Agalas, it did seem much more like, you know, what it should be. It still kind of looked at something like the Polar Stern, and thought, well, now that's a real, that's the real thing. But yeah, it was okay. It was good enough. Yeah, so that was quite interesting.
Did you have any dealings with Captain McNish and Herr Funk?
Herr Funk, yes, I remember him pretty well.
He sounds like quite a character.
When I say yump, you yump. Yeah. No, he was quite a character. Now, McNish, I think, had just retired, you know, about the time that we went. That's right. Yeah, certainly, you know.
So was Herr Funk the master of the vessel?
Funk was the master of the vessel.
Oh, okay, yeah. I see.
I think he had just taken over within the previous year or so, you know, so he was fairly new, but he certainly could throw his weight around.
When you went down to Antarctica on RSA, how did you get from the actual ship to the ice shelf? Were you swung over?
It was swung over, I think. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was swung over in a net, you know, net with a wooden, square wooden thing at the bottom. The whole crop was just sort of still there.
There's a very cold sea below.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to backtrack a little bit to the year you spent at Rhodes before you went. What kind of preparations did you do that year? Was it Antarctica related, or was it just general scientific research for the first year of your PhD?
Well, it was both in a way. I mean, it was you know, learning to operate the particular equipment that I would be using down there, and what had happened was that it was originally planned that this equipment would go down the year before. And Alan Poole, who was at that time the Antarctic, I don't know if you've spoken to him. He would be an interesting guy to speak to at Rhodes. He was the Antarctic Research Officer at Rhodes for a long time. And he actually travelled down to Sanai for the summer takeover in order to install this equipment. This is at the beginning of 1974, yeah. He was sort of on the ice shelf, kind of waiting for this thing to come out of the hold, and waiting and waiting and waiting, and eventually it didn't come out of the hold. Then they discovered that in fact the transport company that was supposed to deliver this equipment from Grahamstown to stores in Cape Town had not delivered it. But why it hadn't been sort of, nobody had noticed, you know.
So they still forget stuff.
Yeah. So we in fact had we still had the two instruments in Grahamstown. So what this enabled us to do was to really test out things sort of prior to doing this kind of over a long distance. But we took one of the ionosondes to Fort Hare University in Alice. Okay. Now that's not very far away, but it's at least it's kind of we got an idea of how to operate two instruments and how to, because you have to sort of synchronize them. This one's got to know when to receive a signal from the other one.
And
so on. So you've got to get the timing right. And we got a good idea of what was involved in that. So certainly it was a very good, direct training on the equipment that I was going to be using. And I mean, my background was really pure science. I mean, I had very little electronics training. So one of the things I did, and this was one of the strengths of the Rhodes Physics Department, they later became the Department of Physics and Electronics. Largely because there's no engineering at Rhodes, you see. So they kind of just did everything themselves, they're very strong. They're very strong on the electronics side. They developed a lot of stuff for use in radio astronomy, for example, which is their strength as well. Anyway, so one of the first things I did when I started at Rhodes at the beginning of 1974 was to do their, I think it was the third year electronics course. And I really learned a lot, from that. Because, I had to operate this, equipment. I mean, just by today's standards, it's probably not that sophisticated, but, there was nothing like computer control or anything like that. But still, I had
to get directions out to.
That's right. I mean, I had to, maintain this, keep it running through the year. So I had to know some basic electronics and how to do some basic testing and that kind of thing. So that was an important part of it. Was really sort of technical side. And I mean, these days, very often the people who go down to run the equipment are engineers.
Yes.
So they need to learn a bit of science. I was a scientist who needed to learn some engineering, essentially. So that was an important bit, learning electronics and then, how that applied to the particular instrument. But certainly, in terms of training for the job I was going to do in Antarctica, it would be hard to fault it. We were fortunate in that we could do what we could because we still had the two instruments there. But, it certainly helped, the future, the people who went on after that, was that they could actually train on an identical instrument, in Grahamstown before going down. So at least they, were familiar with the instrument and so on. And I mean, at that time, these days everything's kind of digitally recorded. But I mean, at that time we recorded data on 35mm film.
Ooh.
Ooh. So you had rolls of film. And then you had an oscilloscope basically with a line, thing. And then the film went slowly past and recorded this thing as the sound. So you had these rolls of film which you then had to develop, go in the dark room, put in the and the chemicals and hope, that you got it right, wreck a whole week's data or something, to develop and then sort of analyze with a little projector so that you rolled the film and then with the light above and then it sort of shone down onto it.
It was very manual
stuff, and then, manually from this get sort of numbers from the ionograms.
And then how would you get the data back to South Africa?
Then the data was sent back by telex. I mean, we sent some of the stuff back by telex, I think.
And some of it took back the next year?
Yeah. I mean, we took back, the actual forms and the... But I think we did... Yeah, I'm sure we communicate some of the sort of basic data, which wasn't a wasn't a lot, you know, but because I mean, all the communication, you know, besides the actual, you know, radio voice communication, occasional voice communication, the main communication is by telex, whatever rate that was, you know, it was 75 baud or something, you know, sort of compared to, you know, you sort of think megabits these days, you know. So it was very slow and limited, but I mean, you could still, you know, send data, and I mean, the way we do it would be to type in on it on a telex. You've seen these antiquated things. Type in on a telex machine and generate a paper tape.
Yes.
You know, with the punched holes. So generate that. You know, in the science block, we'd have a machine there, so we could do this. Enter the data from which you've written down by hand.
Okay.
And then take the paper tape along to the radio shack to the guys, to the radio operator when they've got a good connection, to send, you know. Mm-hmm. So they put the paper tape in, said, here comes some data, and put it in.
Did you get to have
chuck it. Yeah.
Did you get to have phone calls with your supervisor?
No, I spoke to Alan, you know, I mean, Alan as the Antarctic Research Officer was kind of directly, you know, but I didn't speak to Professor Glettel as my PhD supervisor during the year I was down there.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I didn't. I mean, I would have spoke to Alan on several occasions. And the sort of once a month private phone calls.
Cool. And privacy mixes?
Sometimes you were lucky and sometimes you were not,
okay.
In terms of getting a reasonable... Yeah, voice. Because that's the problem. I mean, it was shortwave, dependent on, you know, what I was studying, to be honest with you.
Some of your team might sometimes ask you, please correct that.
Can't you do something? You measure it all the time. And say, well, I don't have any control
over it.
So sometimes, you know, that worked and sometimes it didn't. And you had to, you know, beforehand send... say I want to phone this number on, you know, Sunday or whatever. So they would then, you know, try and establish the connection within South Africa. And sometimes you try and phone family or a girlfriend or, you know, fiance in a couple of cases. And sometimes it worked and sometimes the honesty on that particular day at that particular time was bad. And so, you only got it. Yeah, I mean,
it's in telexes.
Telexes, yeah. I mean, you were limited to 200 words per week, I think it was. Yeah, 200 words per week. So you could get one or two telexes. You think how much you can say in 200 words. It's not a lot. That was it. Yeah, that was it because of the limited, you know, communication. I mean, you think now, with bi-satellite communication and the kind of stuff you can send backwards and forwards. I mean, the data we're getting now from the radar, you know, is kind of 100 megabytes a day or something it's just, at that time that would have been completely mind-boggling.
I remember when I was at HMO, they told me about the first computer that the HMO got. How fantastic it was. And nowadays, the computing power of that computer is probably the most... ordinary cell phones, computing power.
Yeah, and it probably occupied a whole room or something.
They did occupy in terms of preparation, again, when did you meet the rest of your teammates? Did you have team training?
Yeah, we had team training. I mean, that was the time that I, the first time that I've met most of the team. I think the team leader at that time, would happen would be that the team leader would be appointed sort of in the middle of the year, and then he would sort of go around to the, you know, particularly the scientists, I think, Rhodes at that time, Hermanus at that time, Stellenbosch still, Botchestrom, and Natal. So Natal, Rhodes, Hermanus, Stellenbosch, and Botchestrom. And basically kind of, you know, meet the scientists. But also, you know, the idea was that he would get kind of briefed by the Antarctic Research Officer or the, you know, whoever was in charge of that Antarctic research program as to, you know, what the objectives of the their program, what the objectives were, and so on, so that hopefully he could appreciate, you know, what they were doing, and have some, you know, some understanding of how it kind of fitted into the, you know, to the big picture. So that was the idea. So I'd met the leader.
Who was he? Can you remember?
Evan Morkel. Yeah. Who, I could tell you lots of stories about him. He was a very interesting character.
Still alive.
He's still around, as far as I know. He lives in Germany. He was quite eccentric. And what he did, I mean, in summary, what he did, he was a very successful leader in the sense that he united the team against him. So he was very good at uniting the team, but it was kind of at his expense. I think they'd tried, I think, the previous year with somebody who'd been in the military as the leader. And that hadn't worked. And I think they decided to go to the other extreme. In this case. I mean, Evan had studied like education at UCT.
Being team leader was his sole job.
That was his job.
It wasn't like
now where they have somebody who has a job and is the leader. Admittedly, you know, I mean, now the team is a lot smaller. Mm. You know, I mean, at that time, Sanai 16, there were 15 of us at Sanai base, and there was still that group at
Groenhagen.
Yeah.
So Morkel studied education.
I think he studied education, yeah. But he was essentially a, you know, social scientist. Yeah, and
scientist between so many scientists and engineers and mechanics.
Yeah, I mean, he'd done, I think, sort of like educational psychology and stuff like that. But he was also a, I was going to say rabid, that's not quite the word, very forceful vegetarian and things like that. So he had these, you know, and how he survived, you know, here in Antarctica with...
Even nowadays, I don't know how vegetarians survived there.
So that was a source of endless... you know, amusement, as far as the team was concerned. He kind of lost it a bit during the year, and I think he started out kind of taking the jokes and sort of laughing, but I think by the end something kind of got to him, and the team was managing very well kind of without him in a sense. So it was another experiment that didn't quite work, as far as team leader was concerned. I think you sometimes find that a group like that, there is there may be somebody appointed as the leader. There's a kind of natural leader, you know, if the group were to decide after a little while who the leader should be, you know, that would be the person. I think with us, it was probably Stuart Lund, the doctor. He's now a psychiatrist in Pietermaritzburg, has been for a long time. After he came back from Antarctica, he was interested in the whole sort of psychology and things.
I wonder how long.
And
did that have any roots in Antarctica itself?
I think it was. You know, he got interested in sort of, you know, how the mind works and things, I think, you know, during his year. I mean, one of the experiences he had, which was quite significant, was there was a guy there who had done psychology and something else at Stellenbosch, who could do hypnosis, and he really could, you know. I mean, it was genuine. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Stuart, the doctor, agreed to be hypnotized by this guy. And it was amazing, you know. I mean, you know, to watch it. I think it had quite an effect on him. You know, quite a profound effect on him. That was one of the things I think that he decided. Yes, actually, you know, this is an interesting thing to deal with.
He hypnotized on the team.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think he told them that in his interview.
I doubt it very much.
But I mean, he'd done psychology initially, I think, and then studied forestry, I think, or was the other way around. Anyway, he'd done both of those things at Tillabot. But he was actually down as a meteorologist.
Okay.
One of the meteorologists, Stefan Portman. So you know, as far as leadership goes, I mean, he was the natural guy, and certainly the with the small group that was at Grünhagner, there were two geologists, a surveyor, radio operator, and diesel mechanic. And Richard Otto, who was the surveyor, was both the sort of he was kind of deputy leader of, you know, the team overall and sort of leader of that group, and he was the natural leader anyway. You know, so that kind of worked out very well. And he basically sort of, you know, ran that operation. But they were the last group, you know, we were also at the end of an era, in two senses. That they were the last group of geologists to overwinter at Grünhagner. You know, they decided after that actually, you know, these guys spent, you know, more than 6 months just sitting around. Well, they spent basically a year in Antarctica in order to do 2 months' work in the summer, you know. And the rest of the year they were just sitting around. We can't go out and collect rocks in the winter.
No.
So they decided that was not terribly, you know, cost-effective. Mm-hmm. And they actually withdrew the geologists from then until the SA Gullis in 1979 or 80, of course. And then then the geologists would just go down for the summer. But I mean, up to 1975, they overwintered, sat at Grünhagner, in what was kind of a big tent, you know, under the snow, and with virtually no privacy. I mean, it was kind of, you know,
communal sleeping.
And not very pleasant. Yeah, not very pleasant conditions, and the other thing was that of course there was a doctor, but he was at Sanaa, and these five guys were at Grünhagner, 250 kilometres away, which was, you know, impossible to reach in winter, even close to winter, and so one of the things that these five guys were advised to do before they went down was to have their appendix removed. So, because if they're there and they're, you know, the appendix goes. Anyway, the one guy, diesel mechanic, Sandor Roshnai, Hungarian guy, he said, no, he's not having his appendix out. If he dies, he's dying with his appendix, to that effect. So, I think the others sort of followed the advice. Anyway, so he went down, of course, in the middle of winter. Sandor's appendix started or something. Yeah. Yeah, they suspected it started rumbling. So what they had was one of the arrangement was for that group that one of them would have done a sort of like a first aid course. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sort of minor things they could at least handle. And that was one of the geologists, Graham Meinecke, who had done this. And he was then, you know, sort of on the radio to Stuart at Sanaa saying, you know, how do I remove this guy's appendix? Fortunately, maybe it was simply the scariness of actually having it done that it's kind of subsided. But it was a real scare, I think. You know, it would have been interesting to see if you could have pulled that off.
The podcast said that they... I mean, one would assume they would undergo some sort of personality or character change.
Yeah.
Anything that you guys could notice? Because you probably met and chatted with them on the ship at least.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, they came back to Sanaa, you know, shortly before the ship came back. They obviously were, I mean, they kind of remained a close-knit group. You know, I mean, five, I think, is small enough that you can't really sort of subdivide.
No.
So certainly they remained a the close knit group. I think it'd be hard to say. I mean, I think we all, you know, everybody that goes spends a year down there.
You would change, otherwise you're not really human.
I don't remember anything sort of specific to them, you know, that as a result of their, you know, even further isolation, as it were. But, I mean, there must have been something, you know, because it was a bit more extreme than our isolation.
Did you guys have motorised transport, or did you still have dogs?
We had motorised transport. That's the other thing where we were the end of Nero. We were the last group to have dogs. And the last remaining dogs came back with us at the end of the year, beginning of 1976.
That's the team. André du Plessis was in your team, I think.
Yeah.
Was he?
I think he was the...
I interviewed someone else who was on Lost team to get better dogs.
Yeah.
Not sure.
Yeah. No. Was he part of the...
Maybe he was on the team before.
Yeah.
Or the team after. Oh, well.
Yeah. That was actually a very nice thing to have, you know, to have the dogs there as a kind of, they weren't used as a kind of a serious means of transport in the sense, you know, that if we had to do any work or anything, you know, take the muskegs and things like that, because we had the caterpillars, I mean, a lot smaller than they have, the ones they have now, but essentially caterpillars to do the, you know, real hard work. And then we had these muskeg, these Canadian sort of similar things, but much smaller with a cab and everything. And it was the time when, what is his name, the guy at the Department of Transport, Van Rensburg, who was into kind of experimenting with different kinds of vehicles in Antarctica. So he would send like one of these vehicles down and, you know, see what happened. And one of them was sort of being driven from the book to where it was offloaded to Sanai, and it got sort of about 5 kilometres from Sanai and wouldn't go any further. So it just remained there. That was one experiment that didn't work. And then we had one petrol muskeg and a diesel muskeg and this, and you know, so they were all kind of, it wasn't much kind of standardization, you know, sort of trying out all these things to see which was. So we had petrol and diesel and this and that.
So which worked better?
I think the mostly diesel stuff works better. Yeah, but we didn't have skidoos at that time. Mm. You know, that only came later, yes, 1980s.
And the dogs, what did you use the dogs for then?
Essentially, sort of recreation. I mean, in the summer, we would we'd get in. There are a group of people who are particularly interested. Not everybody's interested in dogs, by any means. There are a group who were interested in, and we sort of agreed, you know, at the beginning of the year pretty well. Okay, look, we sort of basically say yes or no. You know, if you're interested, if you are, then what you had to do was to say, okay, you agree to, during the winter, you know, for example, take turns and feeding them and that sort of thing to make sure that, you know, that. So we had a sort of husky interest group that did that, that, you know, looked after them. And fortunately, Stu, the doctor, was particularly keen on them. And so he, you know, any kind of things where they needed particular care, you know, he would see to. I mean, for example, one of the things, the problems they had was husky would sort of curl up when the kind of snow blew across, and sometimes I can't remember how it actually happened, but the one dog got sort of snow which kind of melted and then refroze on his hair, so it's ice, and then sort of shook it and it kind of pulled a whole lot of hair out, you know. So he so he had a kind of like a bald spot, which in kind of winter is not a good thing. So sort of brought him down, you know, kept him in. Not right in the base, but in the ice passage and so on. So things like that, we had to kind of, you know, look after them through the year. And one of the problems was, you know, they were kind of there, but they weren't officially really kind of supposed to be there. And there was, you know, how they were fed was kind of our problem. So, at the beginning of the year, Went out. There was still probably an old 303 rifle or something, some mm-hmm. firearm.
Okay.
I mean, this sounds really bad now, you know, from an environmental point of view. But we went out and shot a Weddell seal.
Mm.
A Weddell seal. And this was then, you know, cut up into sort of
chunks.
Not quite bite-sized chunks, but, you know, chunks. And of course, just, you know, put in the ice, frozen. And then, so every couple of days, we just sort of pull out another chunk and sort of throw it to the dogs. And that's how they live.
So you didn't actually bring whale meat?
We didn't bring whale meat. And so, you know, sometimes also for a bit of variety, I think we used some of the tinned food that, you know, people were not going to eat. So, you know, been there for about 3 or 4 years and nobody had eaten, you know, sort of mutton curry and kidney beans, I remember. But they survived.
And then you took the dogs back. Did some of the team members keep
dogs? They, you know, we sort of, at the end of the year, we decided, okay, well, you know, who is interested in taking the dogs now? Because we were told they have to come back. That's it. You know, no discussion, no argument. So we decided, okay, you know, we've got to find homes for them. And there were six dogs. That's right, six, yeah. One guy who's living in Cape Town sort of took the two older dogs, the old sort of lead dog,
mm-hmm.
in front, and another one. And then Don King, who's from Durban, took one, which is named Frosty, after his wife's name is Moira Frost, her maiden name is Frost. So this is Frosty. Or Frosty 2, almost, I think it was. I brought, you know, one of these dogs back to Durban. I mean, it's amazing.
The variety of the heat.
How they survive. I mean, you know, they're actually amazingly adaptable animals. You know, they can curl up in the snow at minus 40. And you bring them back to Durban at sort of plus 30. And they find it hot, obviously, but they survive, you know. Whereas we had a guy visiting recently, a former graduate of ours, who's now works a lot in the Arctic, and he was talking about polar bears. He said, you know, polar bears are not like that. They just overheat. You know, if you're not allowed to chase them because they overheat and they kind of die.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. But the huskies are amazing. They're amazing animals. Yeah.
Cool. And
So what we do is we sort of have this group that we're interested in them, that fed them to the winter, looked after them, and then in the summer we still had a couple of old sleds, you know, for the dogs to pull in the harnesses. And so two or three of us would sort of put a tent and a few days' provisions and things on the sled. And go off and go camping.
Get yourself a little holiday.
Yeah. So we went, we would go like for a little sort of seaside holiday down to the long trip, as much as we could. And that was actually really nice. I mean, as a way to, you know, way to travel, it's kind of slow, but it's quiet. You don't have these sort of, you know, engines
and
things like that.
And it's a bit of adventure in it.
It's adventure, you know. It's just how kind of how it used to be. And,
mm-hmm.
So it, certainly it was you know, having the dogs as a kind of an interest, not quite pets, but, you know, still a kind of an interest, you know.
Sort of a kind of companion.
Yeah, kind of companion. And then, you know, them providing a kind of recreational, you know, facility, mm-hmm. as it were. And I think, you know, certainly those of us that did that, I mean, you didn't actually ride on the sled very much. You know, you tended to kind of run alongside it a lot of the time. So I think those of us that did that, certainly during the winter, one tends to put on weight, you know, because you eat and there's not much exercise.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
That those of us who went sledding sort of lost all that weight again in summer, you know, and then some probably, you know. So it was very good from that point of view, providing, you know, sort of exercise, burning up the calories.
So what did a day in the life of a scientist in Antarctica, or a physicist specifically? What did you do?
Okay, at that time, nowadays, pretty well all the experiments are sort of in the main base, all the equipment in the main base. At that time, partly because the base was down below the snow, you had these sort of little huts, typically, say, up to 100 metres from the base. And most of them, you had to pretty well go out there every day, or almost every day. Check the equipment is running. You had to go out every couple of days, for example, sometimes to change the film and that kind of thing. So what you had was you sort of climb up the ladder, open the hatch, climb out, and then
nobody ever falls down that ladder.
I think somebody did actually, and sort of broke a foot or something. I don't know. At one stage, somebody had had to.
So you got out of the hatch and then...
You if it was clear, it was fine, but if there was a wind blowing, a bit of a blizzard, then you would look for the power cable from the base to the hut. It was kind of raised on poles.
Yeah.
So that also provided, like, the lifeline, to find a way out there. So... if necessary, you followed that out to the hut, opened the door of the hut, like a sort of a cold room door kind of thing. I went inside to check the equipment, look that everything's okay, perhaps change the recording film, that kind of thing. And then trudge back. Then perhaps go and develop the film or whatever you had to do, go into the dark room, spend a while in the dark room. And then perhaps do some more analysis of the data, so you get the previous film and kind of run it through the thing and extract the readings from that. Enter them into the logbook or whatever. Maybe it was probably once a week, then get the data and sort of type it on the paper tape and that sort of thing. So that was pretty regular. One of the other people who were doing things like the Natal guy was the first guy to do, or no, the second I think, doing direct observations of the aurora with a TV camera, low light on the TV camera. Yeah. And so of course they waited for something to happen in a way.
Yes.
And so sometimes they would kind of, go to bed early because nothing was happening and couldn't see outside anyway. And then other times they might stay up all night because there was, exciting things happening in the sky. And we depended on the geomag, it's called, we would sort of look at the, see the magnetic field paper things with an ink, pen going like this, and when you saw the thing going like that, and you think, oh, there's an aurora, so you sort of go outside and have a look. So it depended on that kind of thing. There's good sort of interaction between the scientists, and we each kind of gave a talk to the team, supposedly in layman's terms, on what we were doing. So hopefully, so that. But they had some understanding of what we were doing. We weren't just kind of mad scientists doing some crazy thing. There was a purpose to it.
Was there any group formation between the scientists on the one hand and the mechanical support personnel on the other? Not necessarily anything discernible?
Not really like that, I don't think. No, I think, there tended to be sort of, groupings, but I mean, people, that may be partly, partly by language, partly by, sort of interest, like the dog sort of, you know, things like that. I don't think there was any sense of, you know, kind of, we're scientists, you know, and those guys are kind of, you know. I mean, that where the sort of possible friction came in was, you know, was when, you know, when the leader would say, oh, well, we've got to do this, this, and this, you know, like, for instance, bringing in diesel drums. I mean, you know. And then you try and say, well, you know, look, I've got an important experiment to do, or I was up all night last night watching the aurora, and, you know, so, but we've got to do this to keep the base going. So the logistics, you know, often was kind of in conflict, you know, with doing science, and it was supposed to be, you know, this is where the leader was supposed to be kind of understanding, you know, to ensure that the essentially the science wasn't compromised, you know, by the logistics, the requirements of the logistics. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot more of that to do in those days. I mean, the fuel. I mean, these days now you've got these big sort of bladders essentially that they fill directly from the ship with fuel and take along on a sled and pumps up and down. I mean, what we had at that time were drums, you know, diesel drums.
Like
these. Yeah, but they weren't the big ones. You know, they were honey liter drums, so they're sort of half the size of the normal big ones. But which meant
they didn't really last long, does it?
Well, yeah, but they were handled. They were much more easily handled. One person could handle them. You see, I think that was the kind of rationale. So we had, you know, hundreds of these. I mean, you just have to go and sometimes, of course, you had to lay them out in the snow. They'd get buried. You've got to go and dig them up, drag them into the base. It was, you know, a lot of work, just those kind of things to keep the base running. And then you'd have snow smelter duty, going sort of shovel the snow into the snow smelter. And then, of course, your reward for that was to be able to bath.
And was that only every 10 days or something like that?
Once every 10 days or something like that, yeah.
And English and Afrikaans, were you mostly of both languages there?
We were a predominantly English team, which at that time I think was unusual. But, I mean, there certainly wasn't friction in the sense, you know, the sense between the two language groups, as it were. I think, you know, everybody really got on pretty well. I think, you know, we were a happy team. I mean, there are some that are very unhappy.
Yeah, they
and,
are.
So, you know, we all got on pretty well, apart from the leader. But that's the sense in which it worked.
And did you take turn cooking?
Yeah.
Was there anyone who would you guys sort of preferred not to cook? Except the leader.
That's a good question. Because he would force these strange vegetarian dishes on us. No, I think that sort of went quite well. You know, what we eventually decided to do is rather than just do sort of one night's cooking, was do three. So you have a turn of three. And then by that time you'd kind of exhausted your menu, you know, your repertoire. And then you had a nice long wait until it kind of came around again. So that, you know, that kind of worked well. And again, you know, we kind of agreed on that in you know, sort of meetings and stuff to say, okay, this is how we're going to do it.
Did you have like a meeting every week, sort of a team meeting?
Pretty well every week, yeah. And movie nights, you know. I mean, this is still, you know, 16mm movies. So we had a projector.
All off by heart.
You've heard all those stories.
But I want to know what movie specifically did you enjoy?
There's a couple I remember. There was one called Brewster McCloud. Never heard of them, I'm sure. What was the other one? There was one called Kashmiri Run, which was sort of about this group fleeing Tibet when the Chinese invaded or something. From the second or third time on that we showed it, it became known as Kashmiri Rerun. I remember Kashmiri Rerun very well. We had these sort of, you know, these people would sort of quote these things, you know, as I think happens. Maybe 20 movies, if that, you know.
For a year.
So which one shall we see again tonight? I think it was less than 20, I'm sure. So, you know, we'd have that and kind of, you know, structure that in a way, have a kind of fairly regular, like, Saturday night, you know, Saturday night movies.
Okay, I'm free.
Yeah.
And did you get a cigarette and alcohol ration from the department?
Yes, that's right,
And does everybody smoke on the team?
No, so that was actually a great source of bargaining power, you know, towards the end, especially. It's I mean, everybody had to kind of, if they're a smoker, you know, work out, well, you know, how many cigarettes am I going to need to see me through a year? Try and estimate that, And there were some who overestimated, there were some who underestimated, and they were in trouble. I at that time I was smoking a pipe, so I took down a whole, you know, a lot of pipe tobacco. And I continued that, you know, through the time I was there and for a little while afterwards. There was one guy who actually went down smoking and gave up while he was there, which is quite a
quite other way around. I would think most people start smoking rather than give up.
And I said a couple of people whose ration ran out, and then they got, you know, pretty desperate. So you had to sort of bargain with power. What can you give me? What can you do for
me? And I'll give you my
trade a couple of skivvy duties for a carton of cigarettes or something. And the same thing with alcohol, you know, you had this ration. I mean, I can't remember quite how it was decided, you know, that there were so many, you know, crates of this and crates of that. So, you know, and we kind of put it all out on the tables, you know, and divided it up. And then that was your share. And some people use that also to kind of trade, you know.
And some people would use it within 6 months and other things. Who kept the key to the alcohol store? Or did I actually physically get to keep their stuff?
I think we each kept our own, as I remember it. Yeah, I think we each kept our own, you know, under our bed or something like that. The doctor was also like the quartermaster, you know, so keep check on the... Get something to do.
I suppose being a doctor isn't the most exciting job on that doctor.
Stu was quite good at that in the sense of, you know, looking at what was there at the beginning of the year and say, well, you know, we want to, you know, spread what we got out reasonably through the year. So we don't eat all the good stuff at the beginning and end up eating mutton curry and kidney beans for the last month. So that worked quite well.
With the doctor.
I mean, so most of the time he didn't have much to do.
Mm-hmm.
So what they had that time was the doctor went down, would have a kind of a little research project of some kind. And the one that Stu did was a thing on looking at allergens and how... Mm-hmm. You know, how one kind of reacts to these in a kind of an allergen-free environment, So I had these little things of, like, you know, cat fur and this kind of thing. And so he would, every 6 weeks, I think it was, you know, the people that kind of agreed to this would kind of get these little things on their arms and see, you know, measure the reaction. And sort of see how that progressed throughout the year. The problem was the real test would have been to follow it up after they came back and see if there's any kind of long-term effect, you know, from having a year in an allergen-free environment. But I think he got something out of it. So there was something to do as well, something interesting, you know, to do in that sense.
And how did you guys deal with the three forbidden topics of sex, religion, and women?
Um,
Or politics.
Politics, yeah. Yeah. Politics, I think we pretty well avoided. I mean, the religion thing, you know, we kind of dealt with quite a lot. I mean, there was the one guy who was the son of Germany, and there was a couple of other guys, you know, who were serious.
Dutch Reformed Calvinists.
But I think, you know, we kind of all respected each other, and, you know, we could have sort of debates on things without getting kind of worked up and kind of, yeah, I mean, I think we didn't really have the problem of kind of, you know, anybody trying to convert anybody else or anything like that, or you know, or having such a rigid kind of view, you know, that they couldn't listen to somebody else, fortunately. Yeah, I mean, as far as, you know, women or the lack thereof, the one guy who's with us, a guy called Tina Rupping, who was the radio operator, he was quite a character. He was, at the time we went down, may have changed since, but he at that time was certainly the oldest guy to have gone down for the year. He was 45.
Okay.
I mean, he had a son who was about the same age as the other radio operator. But Tina was one of these guys who, you know, who, well, fancied himself as a womanizer, shall we say. I don't know whether any of it was true, but he could tell good stories. And he could recite, I don't know, you know, however many verses there are of Eskimo Nell and all that kind of stuff, you know, dirty stuff. But it was amusing, it was entertaining, you know. So there was that. And then I had a friend, a woman friend, who was overseas shortly before we went down to Antarctica. And she sent me a Playboy calendar for the year. It's 1975.
You know. So you can buy Playboy in Africa.
I thought that was very thoughtful of her.
That is very, very liberal-minded.
What I decided, well, you know, rather than just put the whole calendar up, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, you know, on the first of each month, I'll put up, you know, that month. And so I did, so, you know, sort of, starting February, probably March and April. And then, sort of the end of April, sort of at about midnight on the 30th of April, there was sort of knock on my door. This May. So that also became a little ritual. Look, I'm sure you'll see photographs of the base at that time on the walls of just naked or half naked women. You know, and that's kind of what happened.
Well, now there's women in Antarctica, and there's still pictures of half-naked women.
I don't know. There shouldn't be.
I can't say the department's pleased about it, but there's nothing much they can do.
I think there should be, you know, limits on what's kind of on display in the main, you know, sort of public. There was that. As I say, that kind of, it was mostly kind of light relief, say.
Did you have, you said you had a couple of engaged men? And married men?
Tina was divorced at that time. He remarried subsequently. There was a guy, one of the senior diesel mechanic, Godfrey Knight, who was married with two young kids. And before we left, his wife, he was actually English, he's from England. And his wife was South African. He met her when he was catching the bus in Germiston to go to work. So he told us. And she took pity on him, and this sort of Englishman, and kind of took him home, you know, Anyway, his wife said, okay, you're going off to Antarctica to do your thing for a year. This is what I want, you know. Mm. I want a flat and sea point with a view of the sea. I want this, I want these cupboards, I want this and that and the other thing. So he set her all up in the flat and sea point, the two kids and everything, and off he went to Antarctica.
Wow. And Josh is still in the flat and sea point.
She is still, and they are still happily married.
Okay, great. But I mean, didn't they miss the loved ones terribly?
I think it was hard. I think it was very hard for him, especially the young kids. I mean, the one child, the younger child, had some like learning problems and so on, and that was very difficult to deal with. we said that. I mean, Godfrey was the one guy who really noticeably aged. You know, while we were down there, I mean, he went down sort of reasonably young-looking 39, and he came back a very old-looking 40, grey, you know, really gone completely grey. And I think it was particularly hard for him, with a young family. And I couldn't do that. I must say, I really couldn't, because I mean, most of our team, although I think at that time it was kind of one of the oldest, you know, on average. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think about almost half of us. Certainly at the main base, about half of us turned 25 during the year, you know, as I did. So that was about the age, you know, sort of, particularly if you, you know, graduated from university. And
you already did a degree and wasn't the first time away from home atmosphere.
So, you know, you're kind of, and at that time it was also part of it, you know, say I wanted to have an adventure, I could do that, you know, young. I mean, I'd had a girlfriend, but, you know, so I've, she understood, you know, I was going off for a year and, you know.
You were not yet 25, so.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of today, at least, I'm still very young, actually.
Yeah.
And, but you guys missed conscription, that only came later, so none of you were in the military.
No, there were. There were people who had been in the military. I was not part of that because I was actually, I grew up in Zimbabwe, Rhodesia. At the time that I went to Antarctica, I was a permanent resident in South Africa, but I wasn't a citizen. There were people who had been in the army, certainly. Yeah.
And would they speak about their army days or compare it perhaps to Antarctica?
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple who would talk about that. Compared to Antarctica, I mean, in terms of the kind of living together.
I don't know, isolation. Sometimes people do, sometimes they don't.
Remember anything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's usually these kind of stories of what, you know, what they got up to.
And that sergeant major and the sergeant major.
That sort of stuff. How tough it was. I don't remember anything kind of really relating to.
And when there was tension, what was usually the cause of tension?
One of the things I think was when people weren't kind of doing their share or pulling their weight, you got somebody who's kind of slacking. You know, it wasn't kind of regimented, but you kind of, you know, expected that, look, we're all in this together, we've all got to, you know, make this work. I think that was one of the issues, you know, to say that, look, you know, we've all got to take turns to do this, we've all got to take turns to do that, you know, once or twice one or two people trying to sort of skive off, you know, not fill the snow smelter or something, they'd run out of water, and, you know, that kind of thing, that really would get people. That was the one thing. I think, you know, we didn't kind of, we didn't get into sort of, you know, tense debates over religion or politics. There wasn't kind of direct, as I think there is in some groups, you know, there wasn't kind of direct sort of leadership challenges. You know, I think that can happen. You get, you know, sort of two different groups each with a kind of leader
they
clash.
Separate tables,
Like that. We certainly didn't have any of that. We had the team and then we had the leader. No, but even so, you know, I mean, for most of the time it was kind of joking, in a sense. But it's eventually sort of, I suppose that eventually it wasn't really a joke. But yeah, look, I mean, generally the team worked, I mean, through the winter. We worked together pretty well.
Is winter a tougher time for team than summer?
Oh, it is. I mean, it's, you know, I think the combination of things. I mean, one is just the psychological effects of not seeing the sun, you know, because, you know, the latitude of Sanai means that the sun disappears at the end of May for about 2.5 months. It sort of reappears in July. And so during that time, around midday, you know, you'll see a bit of sort of twilight, you know, on the northern horizon. And I think, you know, that, you know, as I think studies in Scandinavia show, I mean, it really has an effect, you know, a psychological effect. And so that's the one thing. The other thing kind of related to winter is the fact that that's when you tend to get the worst kind of storms, and the highest wind speeds and that kind of thing. So often, you know, you'll be really stuck inside the base for days. You know, it'll be almost impossible to go out.
Not like the modern base today.
Yeah. And so, you know, that sort of cabin fever kind of thing. No, look, I mean, you know, you could go to your room. Room. But it was your own space. You know, you're not as small as your own space. Or you could go, you know, to the communal area. You could go to if you're a scientist, you could go to your lab, or, you know, the radar, or you go to the radio shack and so on. So, you know, you could choose different spaces and, on your own, or communal in different ways. So, you know, it wasn't quite, I mean, I think the guys at Grünehagen had it far worse. I mean, they just had one big space. And how they endured that, I don't know. So the winter, and besides the temperatures and things as well, you know, that when you do go out, I mean, the temperature is so much lower. I mean, you know, people here, you say, well, you go to Antarctica, you know, it's cold all the time. Yes, it is by our standards here, but I mean, you realise after you've been there for the year that, you know, a summer temperature of -5 is, you know, sort of like 30 degrees on Durban Beach, you know, in comparison to -40 something. I mean, the lowest temperature that we had during the year was -47.
That's the kind of weather where you don't survive if you go outside and protect it.
Well, that's absolutely, I mean, yeah, sure. This was also the time, I mean, we also, you know, you try and think of something to kind of pass the entertainment to pass the time. That was the era of streaking. I think the previous year or so, then some guys had done, they said, okay. And so what we had was the length of the bat from the ladder at one end to the ladder at the other, you know, where the hatches came out, I think was about 100 metres. So the idea is to kind of, you know, run naked from the one to the other. But now this had to be quite planned, because the problem is you couldn't climb with bare hands and feet down an aluminium ladder at, you know, -30 or something. You just stick
it. Freeze, yeah.
Yeah. So it had to all be set up, you know, you'd had to have a pair of boots and a pair of gloves at the other end. And then sort of go to this end and, you know, sort of strip off and
get up
and then run. And we were purists, you see, you had to do it barefoot. And of course, the feet are where you really feel it, because it's actually in contact with the snow, and that's where you lose the heat the worst. And there was a group first did it at, I think it was -30, maybe -30. So this is now setting a record, lowest temperature. That is okay, that is fine. And then another group went at -35. And then it got to -40. And a couple of guys said, oh, they're gonna go for it. And at least one of them had you know, a bit of a problem on his feet, you know, for a little while afterwards. Didn't sound okay, that's it. But yeah, you know, it's all very silly, but it was, yeah, it just kind of fun to liven up the,
Like I said, that day, I think it's something that continues and it's something that's not necessarily unique to Sinai.
Yeah, yeah.
What is interesting to me is that the it's usually the men. You wouldn't really find the women participating in that now.
I don't know.
No, and back then, it is just something interesting about men together liking to streak. But I'm not a sociologist.
No, I'm sure there'd be some interesting,
there's some interesting studies on that. So, apart from the bit of frostbite, was there any other medical emergencies in the, pseudo-appendix emergency?
No, I think, most of what the doctor did during the year was probably dentistry, people's teeth.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. It may well be, I think especially at that time, the kind of some of the fillings and things we had, would be more affected by the cold than some metal fillings and stuff like that. I think Stuart had like a sort of 2-week crash course in dentistry before he went down, and that's what he ended up doing most of, I think. We didn't have any real broken bones and things that I remember. I mean, the one thing I remember was actually right at the end of the year, I think just before the new team arrived. I was the editor of what's called Sonny's Boss, which is kind of the yearly kind of magazine or whatever you want to call it. And I'd been printing out using the telex machines. This was interesting. We had about 5 telex machines in the Radio Shack. And what you could do is you could get the one to print or run paper tape, and then take the paper tape from one to the next one, and from that to the next one, and that to the next one. So you could actually change these things together to print like 5 copies simultaneously.
Wow.
So this is long before photocopiers or, Gestetner machines or anything like that. So that was how we produced the comics. Like 5 at a time. I've forgotten how many pages. It was quite a few pages.
Yeah,
100 pages or something. 5 at a time on these linked telex machines. Anyway, I was carrying a whole pile of these printouts and I think going to assemble them into the magazine. And I wasn't quite looking where I was going. At that time, they were due to kind of raise the level of the roof of the one the science had. I kind of walked into the sort of angle iron thing here, or just here, just above the hairline. And I needed 5 or 6 stitches. That is the one thing that the doctor was able to do. It certainly didn't really have any real serious emergencies. I think there have been years when there's been much, been more. There have been some serious things to do.
But I suppose the doctor did have to hand out some headache pills, some more.
Those kind of things.
What did you guys do in midwinter?
We had a variety show. We had a sort of multi-course dinner. Again, I think Stuart's good at planning that. We had a few kind of luxuries that, we're going to kind of keep these for midwinter and so on. And we did a kind of variety show, and you get all these hidden talents coming out. But of course, the thing was, when you're going to do sketches, who's going to dress up as the girl? There's kind of issue. But it was really fun. It just went on right through the night. By sort of 4 a.m. the last few people are sort of still hanging in there and last block of beer.
And did you guys get messages from other bases at that time?
Yeah, there was a great sense of the sort of international nature of Antarctica and sort of being in it together. Here we are, this kind of isolated little spots around this vast continent, and we're kind of able to talk to each other over the radio, but we probably never see each other. But still, there was a sense of sort of camaraderie, and Stuart in particular, his one of his good mates had applied to, I think it was one of the Australian bases, and had gone down as a doctor to one of the Australian bases. So he was in, you know, sort of particular communication with them. And so we had, you know, had quite a, it was interesting sometimes to talk to these guys. We even tried to talk to the Russians, you know. Of course, at that time, South Africa.
At the time, trying to talk to the Red Danger. Red Force.
And we even set up with them a game of chess.
With the Russians.
With the Russians, yeah. So we would have a chess board, Sanai. They would have a chess board at Novoladovskaya. And, the radio operator would say, you know, pawn to G5 or something, and follow the moves, and then they'd send back another move. Mm. Yes. So we played chess against the Russians. I can't remember who won, they probably did. but that was to be expected. So there really was a sense of this kind of camaraderie amongst the various Antarctic bases.
And on your way to Antarctica, did you have a crossing the Polar Circle ceremony?
Yeah.
On your first trip?
First trip? I'm sure we must have gone.
I'm trying to figure out when that started.
Yeah.
South African tradition, because it was certainly not a tradition in the 60s.
Yeah. Actually, did we? No, I know it was such a big thing when we went down for the takeover in the mid-1980s. But I don't remember it. If it was, it was a minor thing compared to, I think, what it became a little bit later.
Yeah. I think in the 80s in Magalhães, it was quite the experience.
Yeah, it was, it seemed, I managed to avoid it in the 80s because it wasn't my first time. But, just looking at it from the outside, I thought, well, I'm actually quite glad I'm not participating in this. I certainly don't remember it as being, anything like the kind of what went on, what I saw going on in the 1980s. It was certainly, it was kind of marked, we kind of recognised it across the circle, but we didn't have a big thing of kind of initiation with students. What it became. Yeah, I don't know when that, if that started with the Agulhas or when it started before. Yeah.
I suppose it sort of started, because I do it on some other Antarctic ships at the moment, like the Featherstone and so on, but not on all.
It probably takes, a particular group of people or, something who kind of started and then it kind of perpetuates.
For instance, I can't really imagine, say, the Indians doing that on a ship.
Like
just before you came back, when you knew the ship would come, what was the atmosphere like? Did you want to come back?
that's a very good question. I mean, I think it's there really is mixed feelings, because you think, well, yes, I've been away for a year, I'm missing, people, missing this, that, and the other. But on the other hand, you've had a good time, especially if you've got on and not and fights with everybody. Does happen at times. If you've had a good experience and think, well, it's an amazing place to be and I may well, not be here again. This is, I want to kind of last a bit more in a way. So it's really kind of mixed feelings because as I do realise actually this year has come to an end. And this kind of special time. And yes, you want to go back, but no, you don't. it's really, really kind of torn. And I think especially, depending on, for some people, depending on how their love life worked out, there also would be kind of reluctance to go back. That was the case with me. I say I had a girlfriend when I went down, but it kind of didn't last. And I kind of, I got the Dear John letter coming down on the ship, you see. So, it's time to go back. But we'll, actually, why do I want to go back? but you know, and that happens. I mean, the other guy who's actually engaged got back and broke up with his fiance. It's funny in a way. He somehow during the year started talking to some other woman, and then on the ship on the way back, somehow he made a radio telephone call, and he thought he was phoning the new girl, but in fact he was phoning the old girl and said hello, whatever her name was.
Oh,
it was a chilly.
Ouch.
Anyway, I don't know if it was just because of that, but I think there were other as well there.
When you came back to South Africa, what was the first thing you noticed in South Africa?
How fast everything is. I think that's the thing, especially, you know, the time we were there travelling with the dogs and things are slow, and you come back to Cape Town. Aside from the heat, I mean, obviously, but just the traffic and the noise and the people and that everything seems so crazy. You know, life was kind of nice and peaceful down there, and suddenly you're back in this chaos. So dealing with that and dealing with you know, the kind of disappointments we might come back to. It really is, you know, a major adjustment coming back, I think. You know, going down there, it's all kind of new and exciting, and it's adventure and so on. But coming back to the real world is actually very hard. And I really think it takes, you know, quite a bit of adjustment again to get back. You know, whatever one's experience, I think, of Antarctica. It's just a very different, you know, very different environment. And you come back to this, you know, everything just moving all over the place. That was my real impression, you know, sort of first few days in Cape Town. Getting used to all the traffic and stuff.
And what do people ask you most about Antarctica when they hear you've been to
Besides the wasn't cold part. I think they say, well, you know, what kind of things kind of stand out, you know, I really remember. And I would say, well, the one thing particularly for me was the sort of field trip that we went on, you know, towards the end of the year. As it worked out, the surveyor had a sort of a project to do where he was going measuring the flow of a glacier. And the previous year they'd laid out a line of poles sort of straight across the glacier, and we went back again to measure how far they'd moved in a year. Quite a long way. And the problem was that the vehicle that he was supposed to use from Grünhagener broke it down. So we had to take a vehicle from Sadai to Grünhagener, pick him up there, and then go and do this thing with him. So I was actually out in the field on this thing for about two months, yeah. Wow. So we travelled around from Grünhagener, along to the glacier, right down to Borge, past the old, and there's a depot, which at that time was still, you could still see from the Norwegian-British-Swedish expedition in 1950. You know, there's a can of Shell paraffin, 2 shillings or something like that. Just a little depot that they left, you know, sort of emergency supply depot kind of thing near Pyramiden, I think it was, on the way down to Borger. So yeah, I mean that to me, that travelling around that field trip and saying, you know, 2 months without a bath. Then when, you know, when you get back, the shower or bath is just you know, divine.
One every day.
So I mean, to me that was, you know, really one of those things, and just dog sledding and those kinds of experiences that are just unique, you know, that you're not going to get anywhere else. I think the... And what I always told people, you know, was that it is so much, besides the environmental experience, it's as much a human experience. You know, the fact that you've got to, you know, live with these 15 other guys for a year. You know, you can't say bopped out. And, like I think has happened, for example, on the islands, you know, Mary and Gough, that occasionally somebody sort of goes crazy, you know, the ship can sort of come and take them away. I mean, that's not an option. You know? And you realise that you've got to, you know, you've got to make do with what you have. You've got to make it work. You've got to, you know, get on with these people. Some, you know, some you get on, you're closer with than others. But nevertheless, you've got to get on with everybody. You know, and I think we all realised that, you know, and made it work. And so it was very much, you know, say a human experience as much as an environmental one. And that's kind of the thing I, you know, say people don't think so much about that.
Yeah. I get the idea, as other people have put it, you know, people tell you they're not introverts. They don't like people. That's why they went to Antarctica.
Oh, yeah.
That's
yeah.
the wrongest thing to do when you don't like people.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, sure. I think, you know, people had different motivations to go down there. I mean, some people went, you know, to earn some money, not spend it, which is not quite, you know, what I have in mind. Yeah, some people went just for the adventure. Some people, like myself, went to do some science and have an adventure. You know, so you know, there are kind of different motivations to go down. And yeah, and maybe in a way, different expectations. I mean, you know, when I think of the sort of psychological tests and things that we did, you know, if we were down, I mean, I thought afterwards, going through the session, I thought, well, how on earth did they decide, you know, on the basis of those, you know, whether you're suitable, you know, to, and how do they put a team together, you know, people that are compatible, you know, I would say to people afterwards, well, you know, you've got to kind of, in a way, take it on trust that the people who've chosen you have chosen people that you're going to be able to get on with. You know, you just got to accept that. You know, you trust that you hope that they've done that, and you know that you can kind of build a compatible team from the people that are available. You know, because often there's not much choice as to, you know, you need somebody who's qualified in such and such a way and wants to go and spend a year in Antarctica. So. Yeah, so there's that aspect, you know, that you kind of feel okay with, you know, with the other people. And, you know, and I mean, one of the great things that was discussed, and of course, you know, happened somewhat later, you know, was, you know, what about women coming to San Diego? How would it work, you know, this kind of thing. And you know, all these sort of pro and con arguments.
Was it a discussion you guys also had when you were down there?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
What was the vote?
I can't remember how, you know, far it went, but it was probably half. No, I think it was half and half. You know, there were the kind of the, yeah, I suppose conservative half, you know, say, well, no, you know, can't work for women. I mean, you know, sort of arguments like, what about the toilets? Something like, yeah, ridiculous.
Well, that argument worked until the 90s.
Yes, there's three things like that. And then I said, well, you know, what? And then the other thing about, well, you know, they're obviously going to have relationships with, you know, some of the other people, and then there'll be jealousies and this and that, and it'll cause so many problems. You know. And a lot of us have said, well, look, I mean, that's, you know, it's normal life, you know. and in a way, having men and women there at least makes it a little bit more normal. You know, it can't really be normal anyway. But, you know, it's even more abnormal in a sense having only men there. Yes, you kind of, you know, expose the group to other, you know, tensions possibly and so on, but it's certainly... yeah, make it more interesting and to make it add another kind of dimension to it. And, yeah, you know, when I, shortly after I, a couple of years after I came back, I gave a talk at a girls' high school, and I got this question: what about women going down to Antarctica? And of course, that was long before they actually went down from Sinai. And I said, well, you know, I hope that, you know, that's going to happen. And then the teacher said something like, oh, well, I hope something to the effect of, well, maybe they need somebody to go and cook for them or something. And I thought, what? I said no. I made sure that the girl said this. I said, no, when a woman goes down, she's going to be probably as a scientist to run a science program, and not, as somebody to kind of serve the men or something, which is what kind of. I was horrified. I mean, this is the teacher, anyway. And in fact, that's what happened, of course. I mean, the first woman to go down was a scientist, I mean, Lindsay, from there. So, I was part of the sort of progressive progressive half, you would say. But yeah, it was a debate that we had on.
And later, I mean, in the 1970s, I would imagine people would agree, from middle-class backgrounds that have grown up with domestic workers.
Yeah.
And now you were 10, 15 guys having to make your own beds and clean your own base. Did you ever wish you had some domestic help?
No, I don't think so. I think there were times when you thought, yes, well, they should have, left a few labourers around to
carry the oil.
Carry the diesel drums and shovel the snow. But, No, I think the one thing we debated a lot also, of course, was whether there should have been a cook, chef. Because we discovered that most of the other bases had a chef. One of the team members was the chef. And South Africa was one of the few bases we discovered that didn't have this, where the team actually cooked for themselves. And, some people, well, that's a good thing, learn to do these things, you get variety and so on. Others thought it was, an imposition that we could do without. So it's just one of the things we debated. Our training for that was 3 days at the Victoria Technicon, the domestic science department, or whatever, what was it called? I think it was probably still called domestic
home
science.
Economics,
home economics or whatever. So we learned to make cook sisters. Very useful.
Yeah, exactly. No,
I mean the challenge there was cooking. The challenge was to use what there was. You didn't have it. Well, today I want to make so-and-so. Let's we go to the shop and I'll buy all the ingredients. So the trick was to kind of use up what was there, and so the dish that I sort of became known for was bully beef babooty. One very good way to disguise bully beef was to make it into a babooty. So this is what I would kind of do regularly. So things like that, that would kind of use up that food which otherwise might be difficult to do. Some interesting challenges.
And I suppose in the 1970s it was quite unimaginable that black scientists would go down.
That was still some time in the future. I suppose we'd think we're all whites, but I mean that was just South Africa.
You didn't necessarily notice you were an all white male team.
Yeah, that's how it was. Okay. Yeah, sure.
And when you came back, I want to move on a bit to your career also at Antarctica.
Yeah.
Do you think the fact that you spent a year in Antarctica made a difference in the way you administered later on when you were involved? I don't know to what extent you were involved in science administration, but. In the extent that you were, say for instance, in supervising students or so, or deciding who to send out, did that impact the way you did it, do you think?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think it would be very difficult for someone to deal with, for example, choosing people to send to Antarctica, planning, you know, logistics and things like that. It would be difficult to do that without having had the experience itself. And so, yes, it certainly helped. I mean, things like, you know, I'd be involved with, for example, planning what had to go down, you know, at the end of the year. So we'd have communication from the guy running the program down there, saying, you know, this needs replacing, this needs replacing. So you compile these kind of lists of spares and stuff to go down. But yeah, with the, you know, keeping in mind that you know what it's like, you know, and you know that you need to have spares of this, that, and the other thing. It's not just, you know, the guy feels like it. Yeah, you've got to have spares available because, you know, there's no kind of handy shop around the corner. So yes, very, very much so. I mean, that you're aware of what it's like, and you know, also I think from the kind of psychological point of view, was, you know, the people down there know, you know, that you kind of have an idea what it's like. You know, that you want to kind of you know, you can sort of relate to them. That's good.
Why were you involved when you came back? Did you serve on committees like SASQA and South Arctic Officer or things like that? Or
I wasn't
mostly
actually
on a supervisory level?
Various ways. I supervised students, people who spent a year down there and come back and done the masters. I supervised a few students in the 1980s. I helped with like, you know, some of the organisation aspects of the programs. That time mostly the sort of VLF and the rural TP programs. I did attend some of the, later on, that's probably, late 1980s, early 90s, you know, some of the SASQA meetings and those kind of things. Very often, just kind of maybe filling in for Dave Walker or something, you know, something like that. I was, you know, for a long time sort of, you know, junior member of there's this kind of you know, age group that that kind of dominated our department for a long time, and although I was, you know, sort of advancing in years, I was still, you know, relatively but yeah, you know, I was involved in that sense, and then later on I would prepare the SACAR you know, applications and things like that.
Okay. And when did I can remember there was a lot of politics, but more beyond it, I can't remember. Was the physics department always on this campus?
No.
Was it the Howard campus?
Howard College campus.
And this was the
this was the University of Durban Westville, which was the Indian University.
The Indian University.
Yeah.
I'd say the architecture looks familiar.
Yeah.
To Versailles University and Fort Hare and those places.
Yeah. So, and I mean, the kind of setting, especially if you drive down, you know, from that side, the fact that you've got the single road that you can kind of close off, you know, you can sort of close off the place. And it was designed like that.
Yeah. It reminds me very much of Switzerland. I'm referring to a lecture there.
Yeah.
Sort of, it's designed with security in mind.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, yeah, when I say, you know, involved, I mean, that was at the University of Natal.
Natal, okay.
Or UND, as we call it, University of Natal.
UND.
Now the Howard College campus. So, you know, I mean, there's been this space physics group at Natal since, well, I don't know when it really started, I suppose, in the 1960s, probably, when Professor Karras studied lightning and stuff.
Okay.
But the first Natal person only went to Antarctica in 1970. So there were actually sort of nine 8 or 9 years behind Rhodes and Potchefstroom. I mean, they were the first, you know, the first people to send scientists down.
Wasn't Raymond 80 from Natal?
Yeah.
I should go check it out. But he became involved with Bass in the 1940s. So
yeah,
not really as a South African.
Yeah,
but
that's right. I know his name. I think, yeah,
as a British.
Yeah.
And then there was a meteorologist from Natal, and I cannot find him nor his family, J.A. King, that went with the Norwegian British expedition.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I got an indication that he went to Witz after a while.
What is his name?
To J.A. and King. Anymore about him. It was definitely English. So I assume it's John. John. Or Jock. Most likely John. Anyway, I'll check that out. I was just throwing it out there. Maybe you know of someone who knows.
No.
No,
because I mean that Norwegian British Swedish expedition was quite important, obviously, with naming a lot of the places. Mm. You know, a lot of those names were Norwegians because of that. You know, I mean, besides it was Norwegian territory. One of the books that we had down there, which I've never seen since, about that expedition. I don't know if you've seen it called. I think it's called White Desert. Amazing. I mean, that's, you know, some of the stories in that.
It's one of the better written expeditions. Definitely better than Fuchs wrote.
But I mean, the thing that really sticks in my mind is there's that Swedish guy that survived the tractor going over into the sea. I mean, that was absolutely amazing. That's a sort of survival story, you know, real life survival story. Yeah, it should be one of those things you sort of see on TV. I shouldn't be alive. that was a thing that really, you know, made a great impression.
And in terms of students, through the years, do you notice a difference in the amount of students interested in studying Antarctica or physics in Antarctica?
There was a long lean period. I think we're getting a few more now. I'd say in the 1980s we had, you know, quite a few students, and then the numbers kind of dwindled. And I think sort of 1990s. Well, I mean, there was that period of 3 years, was it, between, you know, the SANI 3 and the SANI 4. After that, well, you know, there was very little interest. We found it difficult to find students, you know, who were really interested in going to Antarctica. I mean, we would employ usually electronic engineers, you know, to go and run the equipment. But some of them got interested in the science, but those are more people sort of later, the late 1980s. But mostly they would just go down, do the job for a year, come back, and off they'd go. There seemed to be very few people that were really interested in doing the science. Somehow, the group at Potchefstroom was more successful in sort of keeping a continuous, active group, I think, going. There always seemed to be people, you know, coming in and continuing studying there. The Rhodes group, you know, essentially folded. went through a very lean period as far as students are concerned. I think it's sort of picking up a bit again. We're getting new students. Obviously now, most students are black, most students are white, but, you know,
And in terms of having to go down to Antarctica itself, really, is it actually necessary for a master student to go down?
It's not necessary. I mean,
would it benefit their work, would you say?
I think we often think it would benefit their work. I mean, for example, Zolile Tumele did his master's, completed his master's with me last year. He's now going continue to do a PhD with Dave and you. He went on for the takeover at the beginning of 2009, I think it was. And because we had to send quite a number of people to help with putting the new radar antennas up. So he went on, and I think, you know, he would say yes. I mean, he now, having actually been there and seen the radar and seen, you know, what it is and how it works, it's not just kind of data, you know.
Yeah.
It's much more meaningful. And so I think it's definitely benefits, you know, to see, see where the data comes from, see what it's actually like there, you know, what it means to actually go there and run this the equipment, to collect the data and so on. It makes the whole thing much more meaningful.
I was lucky enough to go down, and I think I told Dave we were like five people with degrees, and the rest, well, with postgraduate degrees, and the rest were all engineers and admin personnel. Did you get it in also start to send down engineers as opposed to physicists?
I mean, that started actually in the 1980s, and I mean, two of the first engineers that we sent down are now top space scientists, you know, internationally. The one guy, Mike Koch, who was actually here last week visiting. I mean, he was an electronic engineer, trained as an electronic engineer. saw the advert for, you know, expedition member. Said, "Oh, that's interesting." So he, you know, spent a year training with us in physics at UND, and kind of got interested in the aural stuff in particular. And came back and decided to do a PhD in physics, which he did with Malcolm Schofield. He then got a postdoc at Max Planck Institute in Lindau, Germany, for a couple of years. And then he got some other job with Max Planck Institute, stayed there for a few years, and a couple of other places. But he's now Professor of Experimental Space Science at the University of Lancaster, which is one of the top, I mean, you know, it's one, actually one of the top, you know, British universities. So, you know, he's started out as an engineer, so, you know, and has really become a real hardcore scientist. Really certainly one of the top people in the field. And then the second guy was Rainer Friedel, who was also an electronic engineer, who also, I think, went to the Max Planck Institute for a while, and I spent a sabbatical there, sort of strong links for a long time. Ryan is now at Los Alamos Labs in the US, has been there for some time, working in satellite experiments and stuff like that. They don't take little bombs.
I was just joking. Would you like to go back if you had a chance for sort of flying and spend a week there?
I would like to. I think, you know, for a number of reasons. One, that I haven't seen the new base and the actual radar. You know, I would just like to go and see the place again. Not just for nostalgia, but I think just to see how much it's the same, see what's different. I would like to be able to sort of fly down, spend 10 days and fly back. the prospect of, going down on the ship and hanging around and then, you know, floating the ship and hanging around some more.
Maybe it's a multi-million-dollar ship.
And then, you know, sailing back. I mean, in other words, being away for 2 months or something is something that I just can't, I'm not prepared to do. I suppose I could if I really wanted to, set aside 2 months of it. I'm not prepared to do that, but I would really like to be able to go down for 2 weeks, maybe, Fly down, Cape Town. 2 weeks and fly back.
80,000 rand a shot?
Yeah. Well, they can do it for the minister. Why can't they do it for scientists?
Why does Antarctica lead itself so well to scientific science and scientific research as sort of the major activity there? And both on a policy level and on a physically...
Yeah.
I know in terms of physics, it's actually a very good place to be at.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, certainly for all the upper atmosphere physics stuff, you know, anything around the auroral region is, you know, is interesting. Yes, I suppose it's, you know, it's from the way, you know, it's a kind of legacy of the Antarctic Treaty, essentially, you know, that it is a sort of continent for science. You have that feeling, you know, that it's not some other country. It's not, you know, and it's not a place where you've got, you know, politics and stuff. You know, it's a place where you go and do science, and it's kind of simple. in a way, you know, it makes it very simple. I think to what extent the kind of isolation works, you know, sort of helping one to kind of concentrate on that, that might be debatable, but certainly, you know, the opportunities to do science in a kind of unique environment, and the fact that there is no, you know, because of the harshness of the environment, there's no, you know, cities and you know, kind of settlements and people just there for a job. You know, people go there for a purpose, either to actually do a scientific experiment or to, you know, maintain the base to support those activities. So it's a kind of it's a purposeful and meaningful spell there, and I think, you know, you also have a sense that, you know, it's going to be a short time, a year, maybe 2 years, something that's been 2 years, and then that's it, and you probably, you know, will not go there again unless you're lucky enough to hang around and the programs and perhaps get an opportunity to go down for the summer. So I think it's the sense of, you know, you're kind of aware that it's continent of science and it's been sort of set up like that. To me, anyway, I'm sort of aware of that, you know. And I'd like to think that it's this kind of, not quite a natural laboratory, but it's something that's kind of unspoiled by all the other stuff. I mean, you know, the things nowadays, the sort of Antarctic tourism and things like that have obviously are having some impact. One can debate it's not quite as isolated and removed from the real world as it was, but still, I mean, to a large extent it is.
Well, yeah.
You know, there's very little, you know, it's really just around the fringes that you're getting. More human activity. So yeah, I think it's a combination of those things. That so the obvious thing for the physics is because there's some interesting physics to do around the aurora, and in the southern hemisphere you've got to go to Antarctica to get that. That answers the question.
Thank you so much.